On this particular day, I was reported for work at Hendon Garage, and they told me, "Oh, you're required at Cricklewood Garage." So they gave me a little note thing and had to catch a bus and go to Cricklewood Garage. I went to the depot there where you reported for work, for duty. So I went there and was told I was on this certain job. You were given two numbers. One was the number of the duty and the other was the number of the route. Now your tickets were all given to you in an oblong box, a reasonably big box. And on the end of this box was the number of the duty and the number of the route. So when you were given that, the chap in the office there said to me, "Well, go and sit in the canteen, go in the canteen and sit there, and when the driver comes, he'll come around the canteen and look for you. He'll see the number on your box." So I said, "Fair enough." So I set off and I went to the canteen and got a cup of tea and a bun and went and sat down at the table. And I was sitting there, and it was quite a big canteen. Cricklewood was a very big garage. Of course, all tables pretty close to one another, and I sat down at a table on my own, and I was sitting having my cup of tea and bun, and I heard some chaps on the table behind me talking. And I couldn't help but overhear, and this voice sounded very familiar to me, as if I'd heard this voice before. So I listened for a while, and then I turned round and looked, and blow me if it wasn't one of the Marines who used to play the saxophone in my band during the wartime, Taffy Evans. So I said, "Hello there." Well, he looked at me and he said, "Blimey," he said, "what are you doing here?" I said, "Oh, I'm a spare man. I'm just come from Hendon Garage." So I chatted to him for a while. When the war had finished, his 22-year service with the Marines was up, and apparently told me he'd had a job with Joe Loss and his orchestra, and he'd done a bit of touring with Joe Loss, but he was married, and his wife didn't like him being away all the time, playing with Joe Loss, travelling all over the British Isles. So she got him to pack up playing with Joe Loss and find work in London. And of course, like lots of others, you had to take what work you could. So he'd started on London Transport. He'd been there a couple of years, he said, 2 or 3 years, and he was driving. He was driving a bus. And then, as he told me, he said, he used to do a lot of playing the saxophone in small local dance bands and make quite a bit of extra cash that way. He told me he was quite reasonably well off financially with that, his job on the buses and playing in bands at night. And he told me he'd also been in what they doing a bit of work of what they call recording musicians, and some of these singers made records, and he used to get a studio orchestra which just made up of musicians from various places, you know, studio orchestras, casual work. So he was doing quite well at that. Anyway, I was chatting away to him, and then a chap come and tapped me on the shoulder, and he said, "Are you on this job?" So I said cheerio to Tappy. I said, "Yeah, okay, I'm on this." So he said, "Oh, don't rush, sit down there, I'll go and get a cup of tea." So he went and got a cup of tea, and he come back. So he said to me, he said, "You know this route, do you? Is this your job?" I said, no. I said, "I'm a spare man, I've just come from Hendon." So he looked round and he says, "Well, I've just come from Hendon too, I just got sent here, spare driver." I said, "What the hell are we going to do then? We'd better go and tell them in the office." I said, no, he said. He was real cockney, take no bleeding notice. He said, "I'll follow the bus in front." I can't do that. Hey, don't worry, he said, don't worry. So eventually we set off and we went to the place where you had to change crews. There were different places on the route where you change crews, so we changed crews and I got in the back. And he said to me, he said, hold tight, he said, I'll put my toe down so I can find the one in front. So he set off at a hell of a pace, and he never got booked, I don't know, until eventually, 10 minutes or so, he put his thumbs up. I could look in the cab, I had my eye on him all the time. He put his thumbs up, he'd caught sight of the bus in front. So we set off. Of course, when we were coming to bus stops, the one in front had been there not many minutes before, and there weren't many people waiting there. Not most stops, there was nobody waiting. So we were practically empty. The bus behind, they were taking what we should have had. And along various parts of the routes, there were metal clocks at different points, like a metal case with a clock in and a punch machine. Well, you carried a card about 10 inches long, an inch and a half wide. So when you come to these points, you were due at these places, at these stops, at certain times. That was to make sure the bus runs on time all the way along the route. So when you've seen these things, the conductor had to jump out and watch the clock and put your card in a slot at the top. And when it came to the minute that you were due there, you pulled the handle and it stamped your time on the card, which you took out and put in your pocket again. Well, I had to keep watching out for these time checks. And we come to a busy street. I forget where this run was. I think we finished up in Teddington, but it was one of the longest routes in London. If I'm not mistaken, it was the Wands, number one route. It's so long ago, but I have a feeling it was number one or 11. But it was one of the longest routes. So I was watching for these checkpoints. I seen one there, and I got out, and we had a couple of minutes. With following the one in front, we were always quite a bit ahead of time. So I had to stand there like a fool, waiting with this card, and the passengers sitting there waiting. Anyway, when the time come around, I put my card in, pulled the handle, turned around, and he'd gone. The bus had gone. So there was nothing I could do. I had to wait for the next bus. And these blokes on the next bus, they'd guess what was going wrong, and this conductor wasn't half knocked. They were getting all the passengers. Eventually, this chap, his name was George Fairburn, I never forgot. His wife was Phyllis. Like the friends in London I first knew, George and Phil Bent, this was George and Phil Fairburn. Anyway, he realised I wasn't there, and at the next stop, he had to wait until the other bus came up, and I got out and jumped in. So when we got to the terminus, the crew on the bus behind came in, of course, and they didn't half set about us. So he said, oh, I'm all right now, I know the route now. So we carried on and completed the day's work. I always had a good laugh about it after. Well, I become quite friendly with this chap, George Fairburn, his wife, and he and Nina and I went out a few occasions to have a drink together. And he was an amazing chap. He was tall, slim, and a thin pencil Ronald Coleman type moustache. And he showed us a pub in Kenton, took us there to this pub, and when we got there, he went up and he played on the piano, and he was a marvellous pianist. absolutely immaculate pianist. I didn't know until that moment. And apparently he went there and played the piano and got paid for it. And he couldn't read a note of music. He'd never had a lesson on the piano, and he couldn't read music. He was absolutely amazing. His left hand was immaculate, his timing and everything. He was absolutely marvellous on the piano. So we went a few times with him, but never forgot George Fairburn. He was a marvellous chap. I used to like working on the 13 buses. We left Golders Green there and went down past Lord's Cricket Ground, right into the city, through Oxford Street and along the Strand and down round Aldwych, the Mansion House, Fleet Street, and down past the Monument. That's where the Fire of London started, the Aldwych, past the Aldwych Theatre, and then the Monument was just near the riverbank, and then across London Bridge to the other side, and that was the terminus. But it used to be busy coming through Oxford, so you'd get people jumping on, mostly women, doing shopping. And they'd go to one store and they'd get a penny or a tuppenny, ride along further along the street and out in, and into more stores. During the sale period, it was quite hectic. You get these women with loads of parcels jumping on the bus, and it was good fun. And there was always something going on, but it was quite tiring too, up and down the stairs collecting fares. But I always think that it was on the one week I was on the first bus out, that was about 4:30 if I'm not mistaken. 4:30, I'm almost sure, very early I know. And started off at Golders Green, and three women got on the bus. So I went round and said, "Fares, please." So this woman said, "Three sixpennies, please." She spoke in a very foreign accent. "Three sixpennies, please." So I give her the 3 6-penny tickets, and we set off. We were going on and on and on and on. And these women were still sitting there. They were the only people downstairs. And I think there was only about a couple upstairs. On this first bus, you never had many passengers. But I went along and said, "Excuse me, where are you going to?" So she said, "London Bridge." So I, at the back of the bus, on the wall side of the bus, there was a wooden chart with different stages on all the different fare stages, which showed you the price of the tickets from various parts of the trip. So I brought this board along and I showed her. I said, "It is 1 shilling and 6 pence to London Bridge." She says, "No, no, we come every morning." "We come every morning to the market," she said. "We always pay 6 pence, only pay 6 pence. So I said, "I'm very, very sorry. It is 1 and 6 pence each." So in the muttering under her breath, and she paid it. So the next morning, on the Tuesday, I went around, the same three women. "Fares, please. 3 6-pennies, please." So I said, "Where are you going to?" She says, "London Bridge." So I said, "I'm sorry. That's 4 shillings and 6 pence. 3 1-and-6-pences. So she muttered and paid it. The Wednesday morning, same three women. "Fares, please. 3 6-pennies, please." I said, "It's 1 and 6 each, you know that, you've been on." So she gave me the money. On the Thursday morning, same thing, three women. These same three women. I walked up. But before I could say anything, she turned round and she looked and she said to the other women, "Yeah, it is that fascist conductor." Fascist conductor. I had to laugh. Another thing that made me laugh too, where we started off from in Golders Green, it was a short journey to Golders Green tube station. Well, where we set off from, they were all Jewish people living in Golders Green, as everyone knows. They used to pile on the bus, and we'd be going along this road, and they'd be jumping on, and you'd be full, standing room and all, you know, you'd throw them off. So you couldn't, that jammed, you couldn't get all the fares, so you used to shout out, "Fares, please, fares, please." And I found out, I was warned about it, what they call it, to give you a pound note for a threepenny ticket. And say, "I'm sorry, I've got no small," hoping you'd say, "Oh, okay, remember next time." So I said, "Done this the first time. All right, but remember next time. Have the change, please have the change." I told the driver, laughed. He said, "Oh," he said, "next time they do that," he said, "take the pound note and tell them to ask for his name and address and tell him to call at the bus depot, Hendon bus depot, in the evening and he would get his change." So I said, "Oh, thanks a lot." So the next person that done that told me, I said, "All right, thanks very much," and before he could do anything, whipped the pound note out of his hand and told him, "You know, can come to London Transport depot, Hendon, this evening. You'll get your change." And then I start feeling my pockets and say, "Oh, I just found the money here and have the right change." They came up with some wily tricks, these people. And these London drivers and conductors, they were real wits. They used to come into, coming back from London Bridge, come into Golders Green, they used to shout out, "Goldberger's Green, Goldberger's Green, New Jerusalem, New Jerusalem," until quite a number of people wrote into the depot and the garage complained about the conductors making fun of the Jews. It was real amusing, though. After about a month of this spare man, I was put on a permanent crew with a driver. We'd be a team then. So they told me to look out for him. His name was Fred Wanstall. So I went round the canteen looking for this Fred Wanstall. A few of them said, "What do you want him for?" And I said, "Oh, I've just been told I have to crew up with him." They said, "Ooh, you'll have it." Nobody seemed to like this Fred Wanstall, especially the women conductors. Anyway, I eventually found him. He come looking for me, and we met up in the canteen. And he wasn't about an inch or so taller than me. He was only small, real stocky. And he was an ex-army man. He'd done 22 years in the army. His boots were shining like patent leather. They were all spit and polished, and his badge gleaming. And his peak cap set on square. So he said, "You Adams?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Right, come on." So we hardly spoke after that. And we set off, and it was the route, the 183s, from Golders Green to Pinner and Northwood. Well, the route took us from Golders Green down to Hendon Central, from Hendon Central down to West Hendon, where it joined the Edgware Road, turned right along the Edgware Road and went along so far, almost to Colindale, and then we turned left up through into Kingsbury, and from Kingsbury through to Kenton, and from Kenton to Harrow Central. Harrow on the Hill, as they used to call it. Harrow on the Hill. And from there to North Harrow, and on from there to Pinner, and then northward. It was an extremely long route. And Pinner and Northwood was quite a residential area where quite a lot of moneyed people lived. But it was quite a nice run. And quite funny, this Fred Wadsall going down through, went through Hendon and down to West Hendon, and before we come to the Edgware Road, he stopped the bus and got out and walked up a little street. He was there about 10 minutes. I wondered, well, you know, I thought, oh, perhaps he'd gone some toilets, he'd gone to the toilet. Then he come back, the passengers kept looking round. He come back and climbed up into his cab and we set off. So I never thought anything of it. Got to Northwood and on the way back he stopped at the same place. Went off, he was about 10 minutes. Come back, got in the cab, and then we set off back to Golders Green. And we were sitting in the back of the bus waiting for the next run, smoking cigarettes, and I said to him, I said, was that a where you stopped, you got out, is that a toilet round there? You know, he said, no bleeding toilets. He said, I went in the house. He said, that's where I live. He says, I went in and put the washing machine on. We've got a new washing machine. They'd just come out. They were very popular at that time. They were called Rolls, R-O-L-L-S. Rolls washing machines. Used to be, pre-war, there was a firm in London called Rolls Razors. They were very well made and popular men's razor in a metal case. But they'd gone bankrupt and this chap had bought the razor firm and he was starting making washing machines. So Freddy Wansell had bought one of these. So he says, I put the washing in, switched it on the outward run, he said, and then on the way back, he said, I just popped in and switched it off, that's all. He done that quite regular. Quite a character he was. He had a broken nose. He told me he'd done quite a lot of boxing. He'd held a title while he was in the army. Oh, I wouldn't like to have had a cross word with him. But he's very funny too. We were going down by this West End and again another time, and he had to stop where it joined Edgware Road. And a bloke jumped on, hopped on while he was stopped at the junction. When we got round the junction, he pulled up on the other side of the road, and he climbed out and he come round the back of the bus. And he walked to where this chap was sitting. He said to this bloke, he says, get off. This bloke said, what the hell are you talking about? He says, get off the bus. This bloke said, what are you talking about? What's the matter with you? Well, Philly Wansell grabbed hold of him by the shoulder and pulled him up. He said, get off, he said. You can only get on and off buses at a stop. At a regulation stop, bus stop. The bloke said, well, I was only getting on. He said, get off, and pushed him off the bus. We got to North when he told him, he says, don't let anybody jump on like that, he said. If they trip or anything and fall, he said, you'd be responsible. The conductor's in charge, you know. And it was quite true. I didn't know that until I started working on the buses. The conductor was responsible for keeping time or any trouble on the bus. If we were on the route and we pulled up at a stop and you were behind time a little bit, you would give a quick double ring on the bell, ding, ding, and he would go pretty fast. If you're ahead of time, you'll give two slow rings. Ding, ding. And he would take his time, and that's how you kept your pace on the route, because you never knew when an inspector would get on. But he was a nice, very, very good pal to me while I was there. It was one morning I overslept, and I was late getting to work. I thought I was going to miss it, and he took an awful chance. He went and signed for me tickets, and he got in the bus and checked out, and he come along the route, along Edgware Road, looking for me. He was going to come and pick me up at home, which he'd got the sack for if he had been caught. Oh, he's a good chap, was Freddy. And he knew all the whys and wherefores. Of course, when you're picking up pennies and twopenny fares and threepennies and all that sort, you had quite a hell of a lot of change in this big bag. And then when you finished your duty, you had to take it to go in the canteen, count it all up and bag it, put it into bags and balance it all up, check the numbers on the tickets and balance it up, and then take and pay it in. So it took quite a bit of time, all this counting. So this Freddy told me, he says, I know a few spots on the route. He says, I'll pull up. I think we had three cinemas and one theatre in Harrow. And he used to pull up outside, and he said, go in and ask them if they want the change. So I used to count the copper up into bags and threepenny bits, which were there at that time, and sixpences and what have you into the bags, you know. And then I used to take them into the box office, and they'd be only too pleased for the change, give us notes. So then when we come to go off duty, we had a lot less cash to count. It was all little tricks like that in the trade, but he was a very good pal indeed, was Freddy Wonstall. Another thing he'd done too, when we were on the last bus from Northwood, was it 1 o'clock in the morning, something like that, due to leave there at 1 o'clock, he would hang on till about 10 past, 15 past. When he first done it, I said, you come on with you, be in trouble. He says, no, I said, there's always, he says, how many times have you missed the bus? He said, I always hang on, he said, for a few minutes in case there's, you know, some guy taking his girl home, and late, if you just missed this bus, he's added. So that's what he used to do, and then he used to put his toe down. Roads weren't very busy at that time of night, and he'd put his toe down and make the time up, but always a little bit behind each stop. He was a tough guy, and as I say, nobody in the garage liked him, but he had a hell of a lot of good points about him. And so the months went by. I got used to the job, but it wasn't too bad at all. Every day was something different happening. Humorous incidents along as you went along the journey. And you're meeting people every minute of the day up and getting on and off the bus. And of course it was all shift work. 1 week we were on early shift. The following week we'd be on the late shift. And different duties there, different hours. And then, of course, there was the Sunday work. I think we'd done, I'm not sure whether there's two or three Sundays out of every four on the 142s. And then, of course, we had 1 day a week off, a different day each week. And they were that busy that if you wanted to work your day off, you could do. Well, with me being a stranger down there and Nina at work in the offices, I used to often work me day off to get extra cash. And we were issued with a free pass. It could be used on all the red city London buses and on the Green Line buses that went out into the from the city out into the country. So if I wasn't working on a day off, I used to hop on a bus, have a busman's holiday, and go for the trips to different places. It put the time on instead of sitting at home on my own. Eventually, Nina became pregnant, and as the time progressed, our eldest daughter was born there, Linda. And when the ambulance came to take Nina to the hospital, it took her to the hospital at Bushy Heath, way out of London, almost at Watford, which wasn't very convenient for visiting. I don't know why on earth they took her there, but that's where they took her to. And so Linda was born. Well, Nina didn't take long off work at all. Along the Edgware Road, just almost opposite the offices where Nina worked at Frigidaire, there was a nursery where you could take newly born children. I suppose there were people working for Frigidaire, I suppose. So we put Linda into the nursery every day. If I was off work or on late shift, I'd take Wheeler there, and same thing if I was on the morning shift, I'd pick her up in the afternoon. So we carried on working, and life seemed to be all right for a while. And then the landlady, this Mrs. Bent, she was expecting. So they told us then that they wanted the front room. They had one child and they wanted the other room, so we'd have to find somewhere else. So we searched and searched. We couldn't find anywhere that we could afford. I had a bit of savings that I'd saved up at sea. And some girl who worked with Nina heard an husband come round to visit us, and they're telling us about some like mobile homes, caravans, a site with these on. So they were brand new, so anyway, we talked it over and we looked, and we thought that'd be all right. So I went and put a deposit on one of them, practically all the money I had. I can't recall exactly how much, it's so long ago. But then the doctor told us that we're seeing Nina. He said these places weren't fit to take a baby in, to live in. So I was getting a bit desperate. I asked for my deposit back. They wouldn't give it to me. So I wrote home to my sister Winnie in Domain Road in Douglas and asked if we could come back. Could she put us up for a while until I found another job? So I must say I had troubled times with Winnie, but she said certainly come back. So we moved back to the island and I looked for work here, but there was no work here again. I kept trying to get this money back, this deposit for this caravan, but I even went down to London again and I saw a lawyer, and I got a very, very small percentage of it back. I just can't recall, was it 10 or 12.5% of it back. So my savings had all gone. Anyway, went back to the Isle of Man, and I went to register as unemployed, but they wouldn't accept me. They said I'd left the job of my own on London Transport of my own accord, and so I wasn't entitled to unemployment pay if I'd got the sack. I'd be entitled to it. Like if the employer dismissed you, made you unemployed, you would get unemployment pay. But because I'd given the job up, and they got in contact with London Transport and asked them the reasons and that, London Transport said they would be pleased to take me back. So that's what they told me at the unemployment office. Why don't you go down there back? There's a job there waiting for you with London Transport. You know, I said to them, well, how could I go down and live down there and have a wife and child here in the Isle of Man? Well, that's your problem. And at that time, newly born children on the National Health Scheme, social services there, there was a dried milk for feeding babies in a silver tin, quite a big tin, I forget this. The weight that was in these tins, it was called National Dried Milk. It was for mixing for a baby's bottle. And this was supplied free, along with orange, bottles of orange juice for babies. Now, because I wasn't getting unemployment pay, they wouldn't allow us the free baby food or orange juice. Amazing, isn't it? So we had to buy our own baby food. Nina started buying some stuff in a blue tin, I remember. I think it was called Oster milk. And our own Ribena and orange juice. But it was eating away at our savings. I went down to the town hall and explained the situation and told them that before the war I'd been brought up in a council house. My family had the council house, but they'd died and while I was away in the forces and I come home to no home, could I put my name down for a council house? So they put my name down for a council house. But still couldn't find employment. As many men of my generation were still emigrating either to the mainland or Australia, Canada, what have you. Africa, South Africa. Eventually I saw some jobs advertised in the paper. Lighthouse keepers. Trinity House. London, the address was, so I wrote after it and sent them all my details of my previous employment and time at sea. Well, I received a letter back from them saying that I was just too old, the age limit was 30. But they would offer me a position as a temporary. Occasional was the word they put. Chief steward, an occasional chief steward on one of their Trinity House vessels. That meant if any of their regular men were on leave or sick, I could work them. But it was only to cover for holidays or sickness, so that was no good. Anyway, I was talking to some people and they told me, I forget who it was, a friend of mine, he said, why don't you try the Scottish lighthouses? The Isle of Man comes under the Scottish lighthouses, which is called the Northern Lighthouse Board, the NLB. Now, their headquarters were in George Street in Edinburgh. So I wrote off to George Street in Edinburgh, and I got a reply to come to go up to their offices and for a medical and interview. So I done that. I went up to Edinburgh and had the interview, passed that. Then I had a medical. It was a pretty strict medical too, with especially colour vision. That's, of course, for flags and different things. Ships flying flags. So I passed all that and they offered me a job. So they told me to go back home to the Isle of Man and wait until I heard further from them. I'd be hearing from them. So I went back home to Douglas and of course Nina and my sister too. They were pleased that I'd got fixed up. Well, I was back home a week or so before I received word to go to back up to Edinburgh. So I went back up to the office in Edinburgh and they sent me down to a place, I'm not sure it was somewhere in Leith. I got fitted out with a uniform and then they told me to go to St Dabb's Head Lighthouse. Now that's on the southeast coast of Scotland, just north of Berwick-on-Tweed. It was a peculiar little lighthouse. It was only tiny, and it was built down partway down on the cliffs. You just walked into a door. It was round like all lighthouses, of course. You just opened the door and walked in. There was like a little office and a little ladder staircase up to the next floor, and that was the light room where the light was, with the dome on top. So I'm not sure it was the only one in Scotland or the UK. It was the only one where I knew of where you went downstairs to the light. Now the head, the principal keeper, the man in charge, he was a Manxman. I just forget his name. I think it was Kinraid. He come from Ramsey, from the north of the island. So I had to lodge with him and his wife and family. They were very, very nice and helpful, and the food was terrific. They used to eat loads of food. I didn't really like a lot of it myself. They made a lot of things with oatmeal. And even for breakfast, you had bacon and egg, and I think they called them mealy cakes. Well, like a fair-sized cake made with oatmeal. No sweetening or anything at all, and bowls of thick porridge. No sugar on the porridge, it was all salt and ooh. But still, there was plenty of it, and they were very, very pleasant people to stay with. Well, I was there only a few weeks, and then word came to me to proceed to Leith again, where when I got there was a lighthouse boat there, the Hesperus that was called, and that took me out to the Bell Rock Lighthouse. The Bell Rock, which is quite a tall tower. The rock is invisible under the seas, just a lighthouse standing up out of the water. It was right in the middle of the Firth of Forth. So as I say, I was ferried out there in this boat, and you had to get from the boat into the lighthouse by Breach's Buoy. That's ropes which are tied between the lighthouse and the boat, with like a canvas seat in. And you sit in it, and the men on the lighthouse pull the ropes and pull you out there. The accommodation inside was quite cramped, but the chaps and the crew were very nice indeed. I got on well with them. They were very nice chaps, all Scots they were. I was there for 4 weeks, and I enjoyed it. It was quite nice there. The only thing, as I said, living in the lighthouse, it's just a circular room, whichever floor you're on, it's circular, of course. And in the kitchen where we lived, it would only be, 15 to 16 feet in diameter. In that you had a stove and cupboards for keeping stores in, table and chairs. There wasn't much room to move about when the three of you. There were three keepers on duty, always in the lighthouses. These isolated ones at sea, keepers and their families, they lived ashore. So there was four men to each station on the isolated ones, so that one man was always ashore on leave. And you'd done tours of duty. There were 6 weeks out on the lighthouse, and then you went ashore and you had a fortnight ashore at home with your family. Now then, if bad weather came about and it was unable, the boat was unable to make the relief, you would have to stay out perhaps another week, a fortnight or more. But of course it worked out like swings and roundabouts. If you had to do an extra week or 2 weeks out on the lighthouse, maybe another time, you'd be the man ashore and you'd get an extra week or 2 weeks ashore. So it was quite fair. It was very fair. Anyway, after 4 weeks there, word came for me to come ashore. And I come ashore, and then when I got to Leith, they gave me orders and a chit to go to a lighthouse called Causewell Point. It's near Stranraer on the west coast of Scotland, the southwest coast, down near Ayr. And the nearest town was Stranraer. But that was a shore station. So, of course, there was only three keepers in the families, and they all lived there. And that was quite nice, too.